the Freebirds. What audacity, what gall they have. But they've got a lot of nerve, and they back it up.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
The following rustic exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello everyone and welcome to episode number 107 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winston. And today, I'm sorry, I'm laughing because when I first did this intro, I forgot what episode number it was. And plus, I'm paralyzed by these weird island rhythms that they're playing in the UWF theme song. This is episode 107, looking at the Universal Wrestling Federation, Bill Watts style, January 17th, 1987. The reason for this is I forget to go back to check in on Bill Watts to kind of sort of do a wellness check on Grandpa Bill. Kind of like a relative, but not one you want to be too close to because you go over there and Fox News is always on the TV. I mean, don't you just picture Bill Watts sitting in some living room in Oklahoma where he's very much like Archie Bunker and Fox News is always on the TV. And he's just going to recite whatever it was he just heard. Of course, you know, there's another guy who does that. But anyway, I don't want to go down that path. But before I get into the UWF early 1987, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, at GF Allentown Pod. That is at GF Allentown Pod. My YouTube page is up to, I think it was 965 subscribers, so I'm 35 away. I know it's slowly getting to 1,000. Peter Winston is the name of the account. You'll know it from the Baltimore Orioles 1966 World Series logo on the account. And I have one more video that I have to edit, and I'm going to be posting shortly, probably before the show is actually released. So kind of a time screw in my head. And also, you may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, more on all you can find at Pro Wrestling Only, both the podcast feed and the website, a little bit later in the show. I want to thank all of you for your patience last week, and especially those of you who wrote in with condolences for the loss of my cat, Brady. Yes, that was her name, because her original name was Emmeline, and I was not going to have a cat named Emmeline. So since it was the weekend of Super Bowl 38, I was very confident that the Patriots were going to win. I was going to rename her after whoever the MVP of the game was, because I thought Emmeline was a stupid name anyway. So I thought about changing her name to Tennille Dashwood, but I also thought that that was kind of a weird name to change a cat's name to. So even though Brady would technically be a boy's name and it was a girl cat, I don't know. Anyway, been changing things up around the house because of all the walls being painted. We took everything down, so you have to hang it up again. So down in my basement, I've moved everything around, and that now the big couch is against the wall, which is what I would usually record on. And maybe I could make it so that I'm not like completely hunched over at the edge of the couch. I really should start recording where I'm a little bit more comfortable. Like right now I'm sitting in a wood chair at my kitchen table, and it's actually comfortable because I'm not hunched over on the edge of a couch where the cushion is just kind of hunching forward and all that. So just recording in my kitchen for now on a different microphone that I've been doing. Other things a little different. Started watching the show The Good Place on Netflix, and it's recommended to me very much. Now, I don't know if this is because I'm very attracted to Kristen Bell. I don't know if I would put her on my quote-unquote list that married people have, which currently includes Zooey Deschanel, Valerie Bertinelli, and a few others. I think Maureen McCormick is still on that list, emeritus from way back, but that's a pretty good show. I love the Ted Danson character being so incredibly neurotic, and the fact that he's always dressed exactly the same. I don't know. And it's easy to get through because there's only 39 or so episodes, so I feel like I'm going to get caught up pretty quick. I almost feel like I should slow play this so that I don't blow through it too quickly. Learned another important lesson this weekend having to do with ring sizes and my ring fingers. Apparently, the ring finger on my right hand is much bigger than the one on my left hand because the one on my left hand, I can take my wedding ring or my Boston University class ring from 2001, and it slides on and off fairly easily. But if I put it on my right hand, forget it. I got to go through like a whole thing. I got to put like oil it up, grease it up. Stand in the shower for 12 minutes in order to just basically almost dislocate my finger to get it off. So you say, well, why would you even bother putting your BU ring on your right hand? And why don't you just put it on your left hand? Well, apparently my wife thinks it looks stupid when I stack the rings on my left hand, even though it's the easier way to do it. So why wear the BU ring? Well, of course, Boston University Terriers, Hockey East playoffs this weekend up in Lowell. First time in 9 years I've lived here, they're in the playoffs 5 minutes from my house, so I have to go to two of the games. It's been kind of a down year for them, but they won both the games that I went to, so you know what must be done. My whole thing going into this is, doesn't matter how bad the season has been to this point, if they win 8 more games, they will be national champions. And that's all there is to it. But you have to qualify for the tournament first. They have to win the Hockey East tournament this weekend at TD Garden in Boston. So, back to the UWF. This is a promotion that was kind of dying in early 1987, although it might not have been readily apparent to those watching it. You had the oil glut of 1986 kind of causing economic problems in the part of the country in which they mainly operated. The costs of going national, this is a very interesting business study, the UWF, in terms of their expansion and why they failed. Somebody may have done this already. I was going to put together a chart of, you know, their numbers and all that, but I figured that Ringside News would probably just steal it and then put their watermark on it. That was a freaking disgrace. Don't do that, Ringside News. Not that I ever paid any attention to you before, but now that I know that you're just stealing crap from Brandon Thurston, I'm not going to stand for that. So I'm going to call that out. The syndication pay to play that they had was just creating this incredible overhead, and they're having it in places where they couldn't necessarily run shows. So a slower expansion would have been more wise, you would think, where, okay, expand to a city when you're about to run a show there. You know, do it a couple of months ahead of time. But there really wasn't the time for it because the WWF monster was getting so big. Had they started this perhaps a year and a half earlier, it's something that would have worked, I think, maybe a little bit better. It still may have been doomed to fail. The one question that I was asking myself, and this is probably something that could not have happened, is could the UWF have paid $1 million for the TBS time slot in 1985 the way the Jim Crockett Promotions did, buying it from the WWF and then getting that 6:05 time slot? The answer is probably not. Because I don't picture a Bill Watts promotion making that big of a buy like that, even though I think it would have worked out for them in the long run. This show, which is labeled January 17th, 1987 UWF, there's a weird thing about this, which I'll get into, because it's something that aired 5 years later, as you can figure out from the commercials that are going to be on the show. And it's something of an ICW show, International Championship, or IWCCW, International World Class Championship Wrestling, from the Northeast. I can't quite wrap my head around it, but it's like, okay, here's this promotion named this, but we're just going to show old UWF shows. It's kind of like, it reminded me of that Simpsons where Homer is the clown and he presents the award for the most promising new series on cable.
And now the winner for the most promising new series on cable, Old Starsky and Hutches.
Accepting the award is the son of the guy who played Huggy Bear.
I love that gag so much because the actual son of the guy who played Huggy Bear went on to become a running back for the Oakland Raiders, Justin Fargus, at some point down the road. So it would also be great if, like, in the Observer Awards for the best wrestling TV show, like, old episodes of whatever of UWF ended up winning the award. I mean, it's no less absurd than Being the Elite or whatever, a show with no actual wrestling on it, getting second place in the Observer Awards balloting. And that's all about the Observer Awards that I'm going to say, because most of them tend to be, you know, kind of a joke or whatever. I'm just waiting for the year where the voters finally get together for most disgusting promotional tactic and actually vote for Dave Meltzer's incredibly annoying Twitter persona. Like, I don't know why anybody pays attention to him. So anyway, why don't I focus on the actual UWF here? And as we get into this, you're going to see all the various stars, but things are starting to fade out because Hacksaw Jim Duggan is about to leave. So it's interesting, he's not front and center the way he had been for about 3 years previous to this point. You're still going to see Ted DiBiase, Dr. Death, Steve Williams, but even DiBiase is going to be gone in 5 or 6 months, shortly after the sale to Jim Crockett Promotions in April, which I always kind of picture in my head. That gets closed in early April, so that's about a week or two after WrestleMania 3. And I could just imagine Bill Watts finding out that, all right, they put that many people in the Pontiac Silverdome? Oh, shit, I might as well cash out right now. Of course, it took him a while to get his friggin' money, because Crockett ran into those money issues, and I don't know if he ever got paid whole on it, but I know that the Ted Turner buyout of Jim Crockett Promotions ended up making, you know, Bill Watts some money, or gave him some money from what was owed. So, like, our UWF television champion at this time is Savannah Jack, a guy who, I've done 106 episodes of this show previous to this, and I've never given him one thought, because he's such an odd footnote in wrestling history, as I'll get to on this show. We're also going to see the tag team of Eddie Gilbert's team, Rick Steiner and Sting, a very, very young and green Sting, as you'll be able to see from the Stinger's finisher in this match is kind of peculiar and kind of scared the crap out of me a little bit based on what happened. As you heard at the top of the show, Jim Ross talking about the Freebirds, and Michael Hayes is the color guy on this, but Terry Gordy is kind of running roughshod over everybody because he had lost the UWF title via forfeit, which is a storyline that creeps up here again. That was back November of 86, but still a little sore about that a couple of months later. He and Buddy Roberts are supposed to take on the tag team champions, Terry Taylor and Hacksaw Jim Duggan, in this one, but it never quite comes to be. We'll take a look at that one. We'll also see the UWF champion in action, the one-man gang, who is still smarting from a loss to Ted DiBiase in a non-title match, which they showed highlights of later in the show. The tag team of the Missing Link and Iceman Parsons under the tutelage, for whatever that is worth, of Dark Journey. And Dark Journey is also supposed to have a match, a Lumberjack or Lumberjill match. I guess it's Lumberjacks, because I think it would be guys around the ring, because I think they're the only two women in the promotion. Dark Journey versus Missy Hyatt, but something happens there that may have had something to do with Missy's views on Dark Journey off screen, but I'll get into all that. As mentioned, this is episode 107, so as I've been doing, I'm going to take a look at sports moments, you know, maybe ones that have been overlooked or forgotten, or ones that, you know, you certainly remember and all that from the year 2007. So why don't I kick it off with one of those?
Maybe one last gasp here for the Oilers. Bergeron fans on a pass. Stephen steals and he'll ice it. Oh, at least I thought he was going to until he blew it. That's unbelievable. Here come the Oilers the other way. And Hemsky's loose. Hemsky, he scores. Can you believe what we just saw?
January 4th, 2007, Dallas Stars visiting the Edmonton Oilers. They're ahead by one in the closing seconds. Former number one overall draft pick Patrick Stephan is in alone on an empty net, and the puck hops over his stick for whatever reason on the usually good ice in Edmonton at the Northlands Coliseum. He falls down, Edmonton grabs the puck, they race up ice, and they score with 2 seconds left to tie the game. And I feel bad for Stefan because, you know, he's regarded as kind of a bust and he had to retire due to concussion issues. But the thing that should be stated is they still won the game. Dallas did in a shootout 6-5. It just meant that the Oilers ended up picking up a point because they made it through regulation with the game tied, which is funny from this aspect. That one point at the end of the day or at the end of the season gave them 71 points on the season. Had they had not tied that game, they would have ended up with 70 points. They would have finished 5 from the bottom in the NHL, which is where the Chicago Blackhawks finished that season. The Chicago Blackhawks ended up winning the draft lottery. So in theory, if the Oilers had the same number of ping pong balls or however the NHL did it, they would have gone up to the number one overall pick, would have maybe drafted Patrick Kane, as Steve Bennett and I say, the greatest United States-born NHL player of all time, and maybe things work out for them differently, and it doesn't take them 10 more years to make the playoffs as it was. So who knows how things change from that one little error. All I know is when I looked up the box score of this game, I looked at other scores in the NHL from this night. I saw Toronto 10, Boston 2. And I was like, oh yeah, I remember going to that game. That was not pleasant at all.
Tommy Rogers, full of fire, but Bobby Fulton has sustained so much punishment. Fulton may well be hurt on the ring apron there. And Terry Gordy, bam, bam, Gordy has gone to the ring. Fantastic for the Freebirds, and that's quite a situation.
Look, I've had a lot of digs at Cowboy Bill Watts, but one thing that he did across the UWF, Mid-South, all the way to his brief time in the WWF in terms of putting together his TV that I really liked is telling people, you know, giving a brief recap of what had occurred the previous week, because it reminds me very much of like TV shows that would do that, like the previously on Mad Men. And then they would kind of run down 4 things that happened on a previous show that would somehow connect to this one. And you could kind of draw the line on when Watts is in the WWF in 1995, because it is that period where they tell you what's coming up on Raw and then also will show a brief clip of what's coming up on the next Raw that was taped, even if they didn't want to admit that it was taped and that they were doing fresh commentary for it. So Terry Gordy is kind of going on a rampage against the Fantastics. It's a clip of Eddie Gilbert and Sting taking on the Fantastics. The latter of those, the Fantastics, they're about to leave the UWF, so they kind of didn't do a whole heck of a lot in 87, and they turn up in 88 for a really good run in Jim Crockett Promotions. So Gordy is kind of just, you know, we're just establishing that he's pissed off still about losing his title the way that he did via forfeit. And our hosts for this show, you recognize the voice of J.R. Jim Ross and Michael P.S. Hayes of the Fabulous Freebirds. I'm actually pondering going to the Jim Ross show on the Saturday afternoon before WrestleMania. I'm so paralyzed by what the hell am I going to do. I'm going to New York City, and yeah, that holds appeal as well, but do I want to go to the Mets Nationals game? I feel like that would be the most on-brand thing that I could do. My local indie, Chaotic, is running a benefit show, but that's down in Rahway, New Jersey. So while that would be a lot of fun, Rahway, it means about an extra half hour tacked on to my drive. So I don't know. I got a lot to really just sort of sort through. I'm probably not going to go to the JR show. I don't think that is happening. So the tag team titles will be on the line on this show, as I mentioned. Roberts and Gordy taking on Duggan and Taylor, or so we hope. But Michael Hayes is very excited about the Dark Journey versus Missy Hyatt main event that we have, and he lets us know in a very colorful way.
Savannah Jack,
plus the broads, man. The broads are fighting on TV with lumberjack rules, man. That means you can fondle them
girls,
when you throw them back
girls,
in.
Girls, man. Ladies. Ladies.
With lumberjack
rules. One's a ghetto
broad. The other's got her nose stuck so far up in the air.
Now, if you think he crossed the line there, maybe you should listen to Michael Hayes talk to Mark Henry on what it means to be African-American in the United States. I'm just saying, it's not the worst thing he's ever done. So we go into our opening match, which is the very odd team of the Missing Link and Iceman King Parsons, with Dark Journey taking on Ken Massey and Jack Victory. Now, Jack Victory, he's a guy that is ingrained in my head for two things, being every masked guy in 1989 NWA WCW, but also for feuding with New Jack in 1998, where I just hated him so much and could never really figure out why, could never trace back my just incredible dislike for him. I think he might have just had a punchable face or whatever. Now, he was teaming with Hollywood John Tatum at one point, and they said that Tatum would be coming back soon, but with the UWF about to go under, they would actually reunite in Wild West Wrestling later in 1987. If you recall, back in episode 21 of Greetings from Allentown, which was also the UWF from 1986, that was actually one of my favorite shows to cover. Of course, that's something that hasn't been on YouTube in quite some time. Dark Journey just slapped the shit out of Michael Hayes, probably because he said something about being black in America and being a woman. So it was probably well-deserved, I can imagine. Now, the Missing Link, Dewey Robertson, he has come up in the past, but not as the Missing Link. He was on episode 70 that I did in the WWF of 1977 under his real name, where Vince McMahon said that we'd be seeing a lot more of him, and then he did not make another TV appearance in the company, at least on that particular show. And they say, Jim Ross says that he has a very limited repertoire. But honestly, like I said, he's actually very accomplished. It's just that the gimmick kind of limits him to what he could do.
Anybody teaming with a Missing Link's probably going to have a style unlike his, because he has a very limited repertoire.
Yeah.
But what he does very well.
Yeah, he's limited any way you go at it. He's stuck for an answer when you tell him hello.
To some, Missing Link is a babyface here. Might not make a lot of sense, but it kind of strikes me as a sort of less annoying version of George the Animal Steel without the fan-friendly ripping open of the turnbuckles and all that. You certainly were not going to see that in a Bill Watts promotion. It's occurred to me that Dark Journey, who is a very attractive woman, I must say, looks kind of like a really tarted up version of Felicia Rashad. I don't know. Maybe it's just because it's the 1980s and the Cosby Show was big. I have no idea. I've heard way too much about her from the Missy Hyatt shoot interview about her grooming habits, let's say. So into the match, it's Victory and Link starting off, and Victory gets some right hands and then does the corner whip, the Bret Hart thing where he goes face first into the turnbuckle, and Victory just sort of runs into Link's back. But then Jack is sent over the top, which is apparently not a disqualification. I was very confused by that. Apparently they just decide to let it go whenever it suits the situation. Ken Massey comes in, he gets headbutted, and when the Iceman gets in there, immediately the first thing I notice is that he has one knee pad on. If you're a professional wrestler and I'm watching you, if you have one knee pad on, that is immediately going to be the first thing that I notice. Like, you could be wearing like Terry Taylor's Red Rooster hair on top of your head, and I will still notice one knee pad. Before that, Victory's hair, Michael Hayes compares it to Brian Bosworth's hair. I don't think it was quite as extreme as the Boz, but he was kind of in the news in January of 87. He was suspended for the Orange Bowl, which I think Oklahoma kicked Arkansas's ass in that game. But I know that Bosworth went to the NFL. He went into the supplemental NFL draft. It was taken in the first round of that by the Seahawks. It's kind of rare. But I learned that apparently Brian Bosworth graduated from college early, which is why he was eligible for the supplemental draft. I thought that was kind of neat. Iceman Parsons kind of gets worked over a little bit. He would be a future Blackbird, quote-unquote, aligned with the Freebirds in World Class a year after this in 1988. By the way, Blackbird, one of my favorite Beatles songs, which I know may strike you as a little weird. It's a little low-key. It's only like a two-minute song, but I like that one quite a bit. But he fires up against Massey, who tags out to Jack Victory. They suggest that Victory is the veteran leader of this team and that he's showing Massey, you know, how things are supposed to be done, how to be aggressive. I don't think that probably went anywhere. I do like that Hayes and JR, they make the old Gorilla Monsoon trope of the winners get more money here. I always like they're fighting for the purse money or whatever. Although the truth is, on TV, and I'm pretty sure I read this somewhere, the jobbers used to get more money than the name guys, because the name guys being on TV, they were there for the exposure. And the job guys would get more money because they were making the other guys look good. I mean, after all, as the saying goes, you're only as good as your opponent. Jack Victory hits some right hands. It goes for a slam, but gets caught into a small package for two, as Michael Hayes calls Dark Journey a, quote, sadistic little heifer. Which, I don't know why that made me laugh so much, but it did. Everything breaks down. All four end up in the ring briefly, and the Iceman hits the ask bump. Yeah, that move, whatever you want to call it. And they pick up the win, the team of Missing Link and Iceman Parsons. Again, a very unusual team. Seems a little bit thrown together and only a team because they just happen to have the same manager.
International Championship Wrestling proudly announces a new and exciting series entitled I Want to Be a Wrestler. Volume 1, The Beginning, focuses on the training and the regimented program wrestlers go through to get their bodies and minds in shape. From aerobics to the weight room, you'll learn all that it takes to become mentally and physically fit. Plus,
so get an ad for ICW I Want to Be a Wrestler, which is a videotape you could order. And the whole thing just seems a little off to me. Like, you should probably go to a school rather than learn through a videotape. But that's fine. However, I would take it a little bit more seriously if they had a graphic on there that said The Beginning. And Beginning was spelled wrong. It was missing an N in there. It's two N's after the I, between the two I's. You know what I mean? They also have allow 5 to 6 weeks for delivery. 5 to 6 weeks? What the hell is that? I mean, you can kill Amazon for various business practices or whatever, but you have to admit that their logistics are second to none. I mean, they ain't going to take 5 to 6 weeks to deliver a freaking wrestling tape. Why is it that shit back then took so long to get to places? Kind of leaves me scratching my head. I don't know. So the UWF champion, One Man Gang, has recently had an issue with Ted DiBiase. They had a non-sanctioned match the previous week, which I guess is to say that it was a non-title match. Ted is, he's kind of in that team with Dr. Death, but he also is in the picture for the UWF title as well. Gang and DiBiase are kind of tied together in some ways because in 87, they jumped to the WWF at pretty much the same time. Then as you roll into 88, you have the WrestleMania 4, which I connect them in that tournament because the only way to explain the One Man Gang's ridiculous disqualification loss to Savage is that he was paid off to injure Savage with the cane to make it easier for DiBiase later on, although it would have been smarter for DiBiase to say, hey, gang, why don't you drag Savage out of the ring and force a double countout, and then that way I would become the champion. See, he really wasn't thinking. And then later in the year, when One Man Gang rediscovers his African roots, blah, 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 you know, the whole deal, captains a Survivor Series team, and who's on that team but Ted DiBiase? So, you know, they're together, and I think that the 1989 Royal Rumble chicanery, I think that DiBiase may have bought Akeem's number, which everybody kind of thought, why would DiBiase want to buy out of number 23 or whatever Akeem ended up coming out at? And the reason is, it's Slick's benefit because he gets some money out of the deal, and he also gets the benefit of the One Man Gang, Akeem and the Big Boss Man in the ring at the same time. So two members of a team. And then, you know, when Ted's in there, they could kind of make peace a little bit later on. They go into this match. Ted walks into a big foot off a cross-corner whip. But I have to say, the One Man Gang looks particularly spry for a man of his size. I don't know if the UWF work in early 87 before he jumped is his best, but I do know that when he gets into WWF in 87, he certainly slows down quite a bit. He's waiting on Ted, who is now busted open. And I'm trying to think if Ted DiBiase blade jobs in the WWF, and I can't think of a single one. I mean, maybe there's something obvious that I'm missing. Was the blade in that cage match with Savage in 88 and MSG? I'm not entirely sure, but not a lot of high profile blade jobs like that in the WWF period outside of Hogan, and especially for DiBiase. So it's kind of a stunning visual to see that. The gang kind of tosses the ref because none of this really matters, and he starts biting Ted, which is always a move that'll really kind of put the sadisticness over the top. He slams Ted, goes up to the second rope, and misses the big splash, and Ted just kind of hooks up the one-man gang in a pinning predicament, and he gets a quick three count, which kind of makes it seem a little bit like a fluke. It's not like he's putting himself over as this great contender. It was really kind of a slip on a banana peel sort of thing.
DiBiase has pinned the one-man gang!
That wasn't a real match!
DiBiase has pinned! I don't care if it was real or not, a real match or not, he got a 1-2-3! He got a 1-2-3 and he pinned the one-man gang!
I mean, settle down, JR. I mean, let's put the damn thing in context. I mean, the Orioles won 5 of 9 in Yankee Stadium last year. It's not like anybody but me is still talking about that because it didn't make a damn bit of difference. However, I love Ted DiBiase as a babyface here. Being a WWF kid and seeing him as the Million Dollar Man, it's so refreshing to see him portrayed this way. Even though you got the Born in the USA theme music for him, which clearly Bill Watts, like George Will, like Ronald Reagan, clearly did not listen to the song to actually understand its true meaning. By the way, kind of funny because the US Express and the WWF also came out to Born in the USA. Both members of Money Inc. had Born in the USA in common. I wonder if they ever chatted about that when they were teaming together. But Ted, you may not know this, but I mentioned this on a previous show. In fact, I did an entire special on Ted DiBiase becoming the Million Dollar Man. June of 2017, so it's been quite some time. His early WWF work as a babyface in Houston to turn him heel for that audience alone, where he says that he's in the WWF, and you get an angle with him and the one-man gang who is already in the WWF by May of 87. They have a match. Gang wins by putting his feet on the ropes, and that leads to a tag team match between Ted DiBiase and Sam Houston against One Man Gang and Ron Bass. Bass and Houston are just kind of happened to be just sort of there. It's also a funny instance of Sam Houston wrestling in the Sam Houston Coliseum. DiBiase turns on Sam Houston, and that is where he becomes the only Million Dollar Man vignettes air starting the next day on Superstars at the end of June 87.
Devin Hester, the rookie who was so dangerous, who went to college here at Miami. He led the NFC in both kickoff returns and punt returns. And the Colts have had a hard time all season covering kicks. It's Hester trying to work it back to the middle. Gets past the first wave, and here he goes. It's Hester inside the 30. Hester's going to take it all the way for a touchdown. And no flag, 92 yards.
On the last show, talking about Andy Chavez's catch in Game 7 of the 2006 NLCS, talked about plays where you kind of lose track of them because the team ended up losing the game, so you think, oh, that didn't really matter. But Devin Hester returning the opening kickoff of the Super Bowl for a touchdown, that was just so great because it might have been the most predictable thing ever because you got this rookie phenom who's returning this kick against the Colts. By the way, good job by Jim Nance pointing out that the Colts had trouble covering kicks. It made him sound as prescient as his future partner, Tony Romo. And that game was probably most famous for Prince's halftime show and the fact that it rained for virtually the entire game, which led to the stadium in Miami getting renovated so that the stands, at least, would be covered because they couldn't put like a full roof over it. And the Super Bowl is returning there next season for Super Bowl 54. I mentioned that several episodes ago about the issues with the LIV for the Super Bowl number. I think they should just use the number 54 instead of using the Roman numerals. I mean, they did it for 50 because the L, just having an L there didn't really work. But anyway, so we're back with the one-man gang who was with General Skandor Akbar. Kind of forgot about Akbar because I think of him as more of an 83, 84 Mid-South guy and then into world class. I don't really think of him as an 87 UWF guy. So the gang is taking on Bobby Perez, and there's not much on Perez. In fact, he doesn't even have a cage match, so boo to that. And the gang attacks immediately, and he kind of screwdrivers the guy's face where he just kind of twists on it. It's really, I've been hanging a lot of stuff on the wall, so I guess I have screwdrivers on the mind. I also am staring directly at one, so hopefully I don't turn into Brick Tamlin here and just start naming things that are on the table. Oh, candle, notebook, water bottle. JR gives a shout out to TV station KMOL, and I'm going to spare you the history of the television station that I often do. Says that they'll be coming soon to that area. I don't believe that they ever got there. This is Jim Ross's baby, the syndicated network, because this is something that he built up, and it was something that made it attractive in a sale for Jim Crockett Promotions. What they didn't think of was the fact that you take on this incredible overhead having to pay all these stations, and to make it worthwhile, you have to run shows in that area, which means even more overhead. They talk about all the cities that they're going to, Hayes and Ross do, but as I said, they never really got there. A very deliberate style from the big man, the big 747 splash. And it made me think of the 747 as an airplane. I'm not sure I've ever actually been on one. I haven't been on a plane that had seats in the middle where you have the three on the outside and then the five in the middle. When I was a little kid, I remember flying Eastern Airlines, and I think it was one of those planes, to Orlando, Florida. But the 747 was indeed the biggest plane, at least in the Western world, in the 1980s. It always blows my mind that smoking was allowed on airplanes domestically until 1990. It feels like cigarettes on an airplane is like, because it's recirculated air. I have no idea how it could work. I do remember my mother smoking a nail on that flight to Orlando back in 86. What was I talking about? Oh, yeah, the one-man gang. Yeah, he had a good run in UWF. He loses to Big Bubba Rogers right before he leaves for the World Wrestling Federation. It's kind of thought of in that, oh, well, they jobbed him out immediately to a Crockett guy. And I think they could have had him lose to an existing UWF guy, but it was one of those where JCP really kind of wanted to swing their dicks around and show who was boss. I mean, that's how it was going to end up anyway. It's not like you were going to have a promotion versus promotion thing, because that was not something that Dusty Rhodes, as the booker, I think, was really interested in doing. But the gang is looking pretty spry here. Very Akeem-esque, and I don't mean Olajuwon.
Thank you, everybody. I hope you have a bright 87. Well, because I'm looking forward to it. There's a lot of new things happening in the UWF now in 87. And I got a match coming up with Michael B.S. Hayes. Michael, this foot is going to be in your face, and you're going to be the disgrace. Because, man, Terry Gordy and Buddy Jack Roberts aren't going to have nobody to lead them around no more after I eliminate you.
That is the voice of the UWF television champion Savannah Jack, a very peculiar footnote in wrestling history, as I mentioned earlier. The latest in the line of Bill Watts's JYD fillers that would occur even later than this. You go to 92 WCW, and Ron Simmons is in that role. It was Butch Reed after JYD had left Mid-South in 84. Even in that brief 95 WWF time, you can kind of see that Ahmed Johnson is being positioned as that sort of thing. Savannah Jack, you know, I'm sure he was a nice man. He was kind to animals and all that sort of stuff, but he was not cut out for this. I mean, listen to that damn promo. Is that going to make you want to go to the matches? You're already having trouble drawing people because of the economy in the area in which you primarily run. I mean, having this guy there, maybe do it a little bit slower, I think. I mean, why not Iceman King Parsons, for God's sakes? I mean, he's certainly a hell of a lot better than Savannah Jack. Just a little background. His name is Savannah Ted Russell, so he was called Ted. He played football at the University of Minnesota, so he immediately passes the Jim Ross test, where, you know, God knows you have to spend a little time on the gridiron to matter with him. And he started out in pro wrestling, training with Eddie Sharkey, and up in his promotion, Pro Wrestling America, in 1985, where he was a member of the Tag Team Champions there. Now, that is not to be confused with Pro Wrestling USA. It's kind of like how the Miss America pageant and the Miss USA pageant are completely different things. Pro Wrestling USA, completely different. The thing that I did a couple weeks ago, Pro Wrestling America, did not have TV I don't think. In fact, I've never seen it, and I'm not sure it had TV for any of its run, but it hung around for quite a long time. There's a listing of the alumni, and it stretches over a number of years. So Russell's in the UWF, 86 and 87. He beat Buddy Roberts in November of 86 for the television title on a night where all three of the titles, TV title, world title, and the tag team titles, all change hands. Michael B.S. Hayes, yeah, that's kind of a fun little thing. I'm ashamed that I never really thought to call him that before, but I don't know. I can't in good conscience call him a good promo. Now, on the other hand, you have Eddie Gilbert, and he's got his stable with Rick Steiner, Sting, and Missy Hyatt, and they're all there around him. And there's something about Eddie when he talks here. It's almost like he's auditioning to be Roddy Piper's vice presidential running mate or something.
He's like, everybody here, and I know you've noticed this, everybody here gets all tongue-tied, everybody gets so excited, because I hear Jim Ross, and he's talking about, well, Skandor Akbar leading the one-man gang, the UWF heavyweight champion, down to the ring. Or he's leading Leroy Brown, the Wild Bill Irwin, down to the ring. Big deal. I don't care. Do you care? No, I don't care. Then I hear him talking about, oh, there's Michael Hayes, he's coming down, he's got his arm around Jerry Gordy because he lost the bout to Dr. S.C. Williams when he didn't even wrestle the match. I don't care.
The fact that this kind of reminds me of Piper in some way is going to take me back to one thing, because around the time of WrestleMania 3, Missy Hyatt comes into the WWF, and she is given a talk show, Missy's Manor, that never aired because the segments did not turn out well, to be charitable. Now, apparently, Eddie Gilbert wanted to come in as a package deal, and Vince said, nah, you're too small, even though he had been in the company back in 83 and 84. What the hell was wrong with them that they could not figure out a spot for Eddie Gilbert at that point, even in a non-in-ring role? Now, granted, Eddie Gilbert probably wanted to wrestle and have an active role, but you replace Piper's Pit, which, of course, is going away with Piper's Hiatus. Let's say plug in, you know, whatever you want to call Eddie Gilbert's show, and have him do that instead of Missy. And you could have had Missy as like his servant or whatever, and bring them in at the same time. I'm thinking Flair for the Gold, but with a sort of younger sort of vibe, a more hip vibe. I mean, I feel like that would have been great. Yeah, I know he was small compared to some of the dudes in 87 WWF, but I'm always talking about having diversity in a wrestling promotion. I'm pretty sure he could have survived there. You know, just being something like he always was at Continental here in UWF as a conniving little cheat who does whatever it takes to get ahead. I don't understand why that couldn't have worked in 87 WWF.
Into right field, a base hit. Unbelievable. Kurt Schilling went 8 2/3 innings without giving up a hit. The Red Sox ace, 40-year-old Kurt Schilling, one out away from a no-hitter, but it's not to be today as Stewart breaks it up in the ninth.
When Kurt Schilling had his no-hitter broken up in August of 2007, I remember it was an afternoon game out in Oakland, and I was kind of bummed out for the guy because he's nearing the end of a long career. And then I heard the next day that around Major League Baseball, players in various clubhouses watching it on the TV rejoiced and cheered when Kurt Schilling lost his no-hitter. And I was like, wow, you guys are a bunch of jerks. Well, in thinking back and having the benefit of 2020 hindsight and all, I would like to publicly apologize to all those guys who rejoiced in Major League clubhouses when Kurt Schilling lost his no-hitter. You were right, and I was wrong. So we go to Terry Gordy, the former UWF champion, who has an interview that apparently was brokered by Michael Hayes. I don't know why they had to exactly go through him. And as JR and Michael are talking about, they show a woman in the crowd, and I tweeted this out earlier in the week, where her sign has, it says Michael P.S. Hayes, and it says pretty sick for the P.S. Though Michael is spelled wrong, it's E-A-L at the end on the poster. But the best part of it, other than the yuck yuck on the right side, is on the left side of the poster, she's covering up the F word where she had written, fuck the Freebirds. So it's kind of like when you have somebody naked on screen and you put like an object or over where the guy's dick is. Very, very creative there. Or they just got lucky that the woman's hand happened to be there. So JR and Terry Gordy, they are in the empty arena, pretty high up in the stands, so pretty far from ringside. I always dig these sort of empty arena, serious interviews. But the thing that I like about this is that with Michael Hayes not there, this means Terry Gordy actually gets to talk. And I've heard him on this show before. Unfortunately, it was in Smoky Mountain Wrestling in 1994 after he had had his stroke, so it's not quite the same. But you listen to him here and say, how come he couldn't talk more?
Yeah, let me tell you something, man. You know, it's like this. You know, they jump my brothers from behind. And I don't appreciate nobody jumping in the ring with my brothers. They didn't have no business in there. You know, it's like they want to do something when I'm gone, man. Let me tell you something. You know, that's why I did it.
Well, bottom line, Universal Heavyweight Championship. Universal Heavyweight Champ. You're the first man to hold that title. I know it's very special to you. To get it back is going to take going through Dr. Death, I would think.
Yeah, hey, you know, that don't matter to me. Dr. Death's a tough man. You know, I'll give credit where credit's due. I gave credit to you. I'll give credit to him. You know, he's a tough man, and I'll go through him. I've been through everybody before. You know, I'm the greatest. That's what I want people to start calling me. I am the greatest. I'm the greatest champion of all, you know what I mean? And I'll go through Dr. Death. I'm going to get my title back. I'll go through anybody that it takes, you know? It don't matter to me, man. I've been through them before, and I'll do it again.
That's some good stuff there from Gordy, even kind of planting seeds for 5 years from now, the Miracle Violence connection with Dr. Death, you know, showing respect for him. For whatever reason, though, when I hear Gordy talk, I think of him as Walter from The Big Lebowski. And I'm thinking of the Freebirds now as the three-man unit from that movie where Gordy is Walter, Michael Hayes is the dude, and Buddy Roberts, of course, has to be Donnie.
So what the fuck are you talking about?
What the fuck are you talking about? The Chinaman is not the issue here, dude. I'm talking about drawing a line in the sand, dude. Across this line, you do not.
Also, dude, Chinaman is not the preferred nomenclature. Asian American, please.
So to me, it makes sense because you get the dude using that word, racially insensitive and all that, kind of evoking Michael Hayes. You have Buddy Roberts as kind of the goofball. You see him definitely as Donnie. And Terry Gordy, a big man with extraordinary range. I mean, doesn't that just scream John Goodman? If I were to watch an episode of Roseanne, not that I ever would because I never really liked the show anyway, and John Goodman was actually one of the few good parts of it, if you substituted in Terry Gordy via CGI, I don't think I'd be able to tell the difference. Anyway, if you want to discuss topics like that, you can go to ProWrestlingOnly.com. Explore other podcasts, match reviews, features and retrospectives, reviews of wrestling books, video games, matches, playlists, wrestler appearances in non-wrestling TV shows, movies, and more. Such as Terry Gordy's imaginary appearance on Roseanne, substituting for John Goodman. Join the conversation by signing up at the PWO forums, online for over a decade, with over 2,000 registered members and an archive of over 3.85 million threads. Message board is a vibrant community, whether you want to talk about a specific match in the match discussion archive, take a deep dive in the Microscope forum, or discuss more general topics from wrestling's past and present. Check all of that out and more at ProWrestlingOnly.com.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away.
No, Bill Withers did not release Ain't No Sunshine in 1987. That was 1971, but Terry Gordy and Buddy Roberts are going for the tag team titles against Terry Taylor and Hacksaw Jim Duggan, and they have Sunshine with them, who is somebody who kind of disappeared from the scene after a while and just kind of lives a private life, doesn't show up at any of the conventions, which, I don't know. I mean, she was pretty damn hot back in the day, and you can see her in World Class 1983, as seen, as heard on the WorldCast podcast, elsewhere on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. This is actually the first tag team title shot, apparently, for the Freebirds since they've been in the UWF. Now, you think about it, they were in there May of 86, at least, and probably a little bit before that. So it's kind of strange when you think of all the success they had in the years before this, dating to, I don't know, 1980 and the world class years in 83 and 84. And this is the first shot they have at it. It's kind of strange. Although they might fit the mold of you don't really need the tag team titles when you have guys who are as over as they are. I do think it is strange that Michael Hayes kind of stays in the broadcast booth, at least for now, as Duggan and Taylor come out to Born in the USA. Once again, I just roll my eyes at how misunderstood that song is. I'm not going to do any song lyric reading because I only like to do that for hip-hop and R&B songs from the 90s because it really sounds weird coming out of my mouth, I think. And they are attacked by that horrible goon, Wild Bill Irwin. I can't think of another word to describe Bill Irwin, and Eli the Eliminator, very creatively named, where you just kind of, it's taking alliteration to the next level, like, all right, Eli the what? What's a word that begins with E? Well, if we use Eliminator, it's the word Eli is in the word Eliminator. So they attack Taylor and Duggan on the way to the ring, and what's interesting about this is One Man Gang joins them, and he's got a table, but what they're doing is particularly strange. It's not like you lay out the table in the aisle way and then you put Duggan and or Taylor through it. They decide to have the one-man gang just kind of stand there with the table and hold it up, and then they're going to try to throw them through the table and treat it as like a wall. It's a very strange concept.
That looks like, is that Eli the Eliminator?
Eli the Eliminator and Wild Bill Irwin. They're attacking Duggan and Taylor.
Here comes the one-man gang with a table. He's got a table.
Right here in the aisleway leading to the ring.
This is great.
Devastation has attacked the champions. And Duggan's head was just rammed into that table. Taylor's head. The champions are being taken apart by Devastation on this unprovoked attack.
Well, I don't know if it's totally unprovoked, Jim. I mean, you think of the history between Skandor Akbar's crew and Jim Duggan dating all the way back to 1984. So there's a lot of history there. So it's not 100% unprovoked. Although, I looked up the word unprovoked, and I was surprised to learn that its usage over time has actually declined since 1800. So I feel like I thought that that was a word that you would have heard more recently than back in the day, because it doesn't really sound old-timey.
Now the gang throws the table down. Akbar is directing traffic.
Had to be premeditated into the side of the wall.
Into that wooden barricade. This match has not started. And the champions, Duggan and Taylor, were to defend the titles against the Freebirds. And now Irwin's got the table. Taylor and Duggan have been battered and hammered here.
Here comes Gary Young. They're trying to help young Jeff Rates.
They're fighting right down here below us.
They're not getting anywhere. They're not getting anywhere. Here comes referee Tommy Gilbert trying to show some authority.
The crowd is very concerned with this situation.
I was actually kind of amused the way the one-man gang just kind of threw down the table, because it was still good. It's not like it was broken. He could have kept using it for as long as he needed it, but I guess he was tired of standing there holding a table like a complete goofball. So this leads to a very complicated situation where Michael Hayes, and this has to be why he's on commentary so he could drive this point home, he claims that the tag team title should be transferred to Roberts and Gordy based on the historical precedent set by Terry Gordy having to forfeit the UWF title to the one-man gang the previous November because he was too injured to compete, and they force him to forfeit the match, and gang gets the title. So, ergo, this being a similar situation, these guys are injured on their way to the ring. The difference here is that Gordy was injured elsewhere, and, well, we're going to get into all that a little bit later. As they go to commercial, and I'm rather amused by the bumper that they use a very interesting song going to commercial. It is Gloria by U2 off the October album. Now, I know a lot of people are just going to roll their eyes at the mention of U2, but I have to discuss this because I went to a lot of U2 shows on the Vertigo Tour in 2005. I think 11 of them, in part because of the hockey lockout. I had a lot more money than I felt free to spend or whatever. And the song Gloria has an extended bass line section in the middle, a rare bass solo for Adam Clayton to kind of show off on live events. I mean, he's not the greatest bass player in the world, but I like to see him get his moment of glory because it's always Bono and Mr. The Edge who always seem to get all the plaudits or allocades, as Lex Luger would say. One show that I went to in Boston, May 26, 2005, and I remember it very well. I'm in the GA section. I'm very close to the circle. I was on the outside rather than the inside because I could never win that freaking lottery. And they're playing Gloria, and Adam is in the middle of his freaking bass line, and Mr. The Edge, that egomaniac, that Hulk Hogan of the U2 band, decides to just step all over it. Just goes to show that trying to steal other people's heat, not limited to the world of professional wrestling. So then as they go to commercial, we now all of a sudden actually get the ads, including one for the Wonder Ride, which is a shock absorber for bikes. And I was going to say stuff about bike lanes, and fine, if you want to put in bike lanes in cities across the country, that's fine with me. Just make sure you observe all traffic rules, bike people. Don't go running red lights. I mean, God knows we have enough to worry about driving a car. We don't need to worry about people on bikes just kind of racing out in front of us. Although one time coming out of a Bruins game like 2 months ago, we're crossing the street and we're in the bike lane part, which is in the middle, and there's like a curb on each side, and cars are going down the bike lane and they're following each other. I almost got clipped by a car in the freaking bike lane. So always make sure to look both ways. By the way, on that Wonder Ride item, no COD orders accepted. So unlike in that commercial a couple of weeks ago that was on the Pro Wrestling USA show where they would accept CODs, by the time 87 rolls around, although actually this is 1992 when this actually airs, as we're going to see in the next ad.
Sure, you can follow the Flyers on talk radio or in the daily newspaper or on the evening news, but you won't have the complete picture unless you have Prism. With 50 exclusive Flyers games and every home playoff game, Prism brings you the Flyers like no one else can. No one else can even come close.
The Prism Network had been around in the Philadelphia area dating to the mid-70s, and what I didn't know until recently is that Prism is actually an acronym for Philadelphia Regional In-Home Sports and Movies, because they wouldn't just show sports like the WWF, the Dick Graham and Cal Rudman from the early 80s. As great as those are, they would also show Flyers games and Phillies games. Eventually, I guess they would make their way to Sports Channel Philadelphia, which is what this is airing on, because it wouldn't make much sense to do an ad for a pay cable channel that you're already watching. But Prism, they're making a big deal about this because the next ad is promoting Eric Lindros coming to the Philadelphia Flyers. So you're watching this wrestling program from 1987, and now you realize, oh, okay, this is the summer of 1992 because they say that Lindros debuting with the Flyers on October 9th, which is actually the second home game. I believe the opener was probably on ESPN because they had just gotten the contract back. I cannot understate the amount of crazy hype there was for Eric Lindros, just a big dude who was going to be dominant in the vibe of Mario Lemieux and Wayne Gretzky. Of course, it never worked out that way because of injuries. And also, he had more than his share of foibles with attitude, but he was a hell of a player, and the Flyers traded for him, although actually the Quebec Nordiques drafted him and then tried to trade him twice. And they had to decide via an arbitrator whether he was actually traded to the Flyers or the New York Rangers. And that 93 Flyers team, rather interesting, very streaky. They won that game 6-4 on that first game on Prism over the New Jersey Devils. They won their last 8 games of the season, but they still ended up missing the playoffs. Lindros missed a 12-game stretch in January into February, during which the team went 3-7-2. which is probably a reason why they didn't make it. They probably would have bowed out to the Pittsburgh Penguins in the first round anyway. But very interesting team. Mark Recchi, 123 points that year. Now back to the wrestling. We have Counselor Michael P.S. Hayes, Esquire, or at least that's what he's fancying himself. Now, he believes that they are now entitled to the UWF tag team titles, but unfortunately for him, he doesn't have the legal acumen of, say, a Vincent Gambini.
Just be like a little funky promoter, go get him and tell Mike Preston right now. Hey, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. When he couldn't wrestle, they stole the belt from him. Now, if they can't wrestle, that ain't our problem, that's their problem. So, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to introduce to you the new UWF Tag Team Champion, the Fabulous, the Reavers!
You on drugs?
Drugs? No, I don't take drugs.
I don't like your attitude.
What else is new?
I'm holding you in contempt of court.
Oh, there's a fucking surprise.
What'd you say?
What?
What'd you just say?
What did I say? Well, this is more or less a hijacking of the show by the Freebirds. And it's a very odd psychology to the entire thing because you can kind of see the point that Hayes is making. However, you can kind of, you know, cut up his legal argument fairly swiftly, which Ken Mantell does, although he's not exactly a Fred Gwynn to me.
You're already facing a fine for what you did last time on the Universal Wrestling Federation. What? Number two, the reason you're not going to get those belts is when he refused to wrestle, you also refused to let our doctor look at his elbow. Our doctor is looking at those two guys right now, and if they're able to wrestle, we'll let them wrestle, and to win those belts, you beat them.
Well, that was put short and to the point.
As simple as that.
You don't push me around, Mantell. Now you jacked us around too many times, man. Don't you start, because you ain't past getting beat up yourself.
You would think that the Freebirds would have better legal representation than to have Michael Hayes kind of talk for himself, because he got totally lawyered on that. And after making the threat there, DiBiase and Dr. Death hit the ring to scare away the birds, who kind of scatter out of there. And it's really funny thinking about DiBiase again, that, you know, his tag team partners over the years, he teamed with a guy named Death, Dr. Death, and he also teamed with a guy named IRS. Am I the only one who finds humor in this sort of stuff? Time is a flat circle, people.
Maloney in the backfield, first down from the 35. Play fake. Great. Going deep for Moss at the goal line. Oh, did he catch that touchdown?
Stop it. Stop it. That's why Randy Moss terrifies every defensive back in football. If it's a jump ball, it's almost impossible to defend it.
And Brady with a third and 18. They handle the rush this time. Brady going for Randy Moss in the end zone. This is unbelievable. This is unbelievable.
I think I mentioned several episodes ago that I love watching Randy Moss highlights on YouTube from the 2007 Patriots season especially, but the Vikings stuff is great too. Him and Tom Brady only got to play 39 and one-eighth games together because Brady got injured halfway through the first quarter of the opener in 08. 37 touchdowns in that time. So that's pretty good. That Miami game, I know all I could play is the audio, but I should probably just make a GIF file, especially of the second catch from the clip I just played, because he just like reaches over two guys on a heave into the end zone. It's just amazing. It's actually a commercial on the show for the Sporting News, and there, if you subscribe, they're giving away a home run video for the 50 greatest home runs. They show that picture of Babe Ruth wearing that giant crown. By the way, if you're ever in Baltimore, Maryland, go to the Babe Ruth Museum, which is near Camden Yards. It's definitely worth it. And not just because they have, like, the kimono that Babe Ruth wore in 1934 on his visit to Japan. So I'm thinking about this video and how it's the 50 greatest home runs, but up through 1992, thinking of the ones since then that would probably make the list. Joe Carter in 93, Ortiz in 04, either against the Yankees or the Angels. Probably the Yankees won in Game 4. David Freese in 2011 World Series. Scott Podsednik, 05 World Series, just because of how surprising it was. There's probably more that I'm not even thinking of. So, Shane Victorino, I guess, in the 2013 playoffs. Actually, the best home run, it's not anything that's particularly memorable, and there's no way I could find a clip of it. Jose Canseco in 1994 at Fenway Park, and I remember this because I was sitting right behind home plate, like underneath the netting at Fenway. He hit the longest freaking home run I've ever seen off this guy named Todd Froworth, who I think he was a kind of a submarine righty. And Canseco, I think he cleared the light towers, and I'm pretty sure it didn't land until about 2009. TSN Sporting News was the Bible of baseball back in the day because they would actually print all the box scores in every weekly issue. That stopped at some point in the 90s. And speaking of baseball, we got, and I know I've played one of these on a show before. I think it was the AWA on ESPN. But it's Tom Emanski, and there's something different about this one.
Discover the defensive training secrets of America's finest baseball school in an exciting new videotape. This is the professional instructional video that gets results. See how this group of youngsters added an amazing 6 miles per hour to their arm strength while vastly improving their running speed and defensive skills in just a few weeks of work. Baseball World's revolutionary new video features professional scouting instructor Tom Emanski and the same defensive drills used by Baseball World's back-to-back 1990-91 AAU National Championship teams.
Oh, so this actually predates his third title because the Tom Emanski thing became famous for the back-to-back-to-back AAU National Championships. So clearly this is in 1992. We have established when this video is pulled from. But to me, that's not the best part of the ad.
San Diego Padres Major League superstar Fred McGriff agrees.
I'm so impressed with the instructional videos by Coach Emanski that I've given them my full endorsement.
I heartily endorse this event or product.
Now, truth be told, when I played the Emanski clip in on that AWA ESPN show, which is what I'm assuming that it was, they knew each other from McGriff getting advice from Tom Emanski playing winter ball in Puerto Rico at age 18. So back when he was a young pup, he got some help from him. And speaking of some young pups, we got Sting and Rick Steiner teaming up here to take on Jeff Wright and Pete Schumacher's dear close personal longtime friend, Gary Young. But before we get into the match, we get the UWF top 10 as read by a very aroused Jim Ross, because you know he loves these top 10 lists. Number 10, The Missing Link. Number 9, that goon, Wild Bill Irwin. Number 8, Rick Steiner. Number 7, Hacksaw Jim Duggan. He's sliding down fast as he's heading out. Number 6, Terry Taylor. Number 5, Michael Hayes. Number 4, Ted DiBiase. Number 3, Dr. Death Steve Williams. Number 2, Terry Bam Bam Gordy. Number 1 is the television champion Savannah Jack, ranked ahead of all those guys. And, of course, the champion is the one-man gang. Not satisfied to let the ring announcer introduce his guys, Sting and Rick Steiner. Eddie Gilbert, he's going to intro them himself.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is indeed a great honor to introduce to you and representing Hot Stuff and Hyatt International, first from Detroit, Michigan, 265 pounds, Mr. Superclass himself, Rick Steiner. Oh, yeah. And from every man's nightmare, 270 pounds, the one, the only, Sting.
In spite of being in Hot Stuff at Hyatt International, Sting gets a little bit of applause there. And also, where he's billed from is rather interesting. Rick is billed from Detroit, Michigan, and Sting is billed from every man's nightmare, so I'm assuming that they're neighbors. Rimshot. Anyway, I got nothing against Detroit. In fact, I've been trying to go there for the last couple of years for a baseball trip. It's that my friends, they don't want to go to Detroit for whatever reason. My friend, he has it out for Comerica Park for some reason. So Sting actually starts out the match. He is in a side headlock, to set this entire thing up and to call the spots. Eddie Gilbert is wearing a half shirt, which I don't know if I can endorse that, but he pulls it off a little bit better than Greg Gagne during that ridiculous military training thing that he did in the AWA. Sting shows his athleticism with the leapfrog, and then he drops down for a couple times as Gary Young is running the ropes. And then Young, the wily veteran, although I guess he hadn't been around that long, just kind of kicks Sting when he did the second drop down. So Sting goes to work on Rates when he tags into the match. Young is definitely the captain, I think, of that team. And a power slam by Rick Steiner once he gets in off an Irish whip. A little bit sloppy looking. I only give it 2 DiBiases out of 10 for that power slam style because it was a little loose. The man went up for the slam a little too early. So Sting back in with the big power clothesline where he kind of leaps into the air. And then we get a little bit of a strange sequence here, and I don't know if this is Sting's inexperience or what the hell happened, but he goes for a pin. The referee kind of stops the count and does that thing where he slides his hand underneath the man's shoulder to prove that his shoulders are not necessarily on the mat. I don't know what the hell was going on. So Sting kind of pulls him up. Rick is in, and why don't we just cut to the damn finish here? Because it scared the friggin' bejesus out of me as Rick slingshots Sting into the ring to kind of do that splash move that the Can-Am Connection were fond of doing on the other side of the world in the WWF. Except that Sting, you could tell he was a little bit hesitant because the man was in the center of the ring. This isn't like the Bam Bam Bigelow thing where the guy was next to the ropes. Sting has to kind of go all the way to the center of the ring, and he ends up landing on his friggin' head. I'll make sure to tweet out the gif of that because he is lucky not to break his freaking neck on that. Although you could say, it was more of a headbutt or whatever, and he picks up the 1-2-3 there. I mean, think about Sting and Rick Steiner, by the end of the next calendar year, 1988, are two of the most popular guys in all of professional wrestling, really, especially in the NWA. It was transitioning over from Jim Crockett Promotions. But the thing that I always remember, they're teaming up here, and they're on opposite sides the following year when Sting gets turned on by the Road Warriors in that six-man match. But when Sting gets carried out on the stretcher, who sticks around from the Varsity Club to help Sting? Good old Rick Steiner. And you know, I've said this before, I love it when storylines can kind of cross promotions, you know, just kind of using your own head and putting pieces together.
Wisnowski keeps it in, Char trying to go up the boards and gets it out to Krejci. He's got Lucic in the middle, Krejci for Lucic, he scores! Milan Lucic's first goal in the NHL, and the Bruins have a 7-5 lead.
I'm not playing these sports clips to inundate you with Boston Bruins stuff. I mean, that was a game that I happened to attend in Los Angeles, won by the Bruins 8-6. Lucic's first NHL goal, one of my favorite NHL players of all time, and I will defend that guy to the death. But it was a very interesting period in my life because the day before was a Thursday where I'm working as a circulation manager for Auto Trader magazine for the Boston market. And I had decided that I had enough because the business was going nowhere. They plug autotrader.com, and that's still a big thing to this day. So I gave my notice, and I had planned to go back to school to do something, you know, finance or accounting related, which, of course, is kind of where I am in mutual funds. So anyway, I spent on that Thursday, I give my notice. I go home. I start packing to fly to Vegas that night. I have all the regional people from Auto Trader calling me, asking, why are you leaving? You know, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, sorry, it's just time for me to go. Get on a plane, go to Vegas, gamble a little that night, because you always get that little rush when you land and you drive to your hotel and you feel like you could stay up forever. Well, luckily, I had to go to sleep because the next day I was going to drive to Los Angeles, attend that Bruins-Kings game, and then in what can only be categorized as a really stupid decision, drive back to Vegas immediately after the game, like I was driving home from work or something like that, even though it is a 4-hour and 15-minute drive to where I was going. When you're in a rental car, there are certain things you couldn't do. Like, I couldn't smoke a cigarette to stay awake or anything. So by the time I got past, like, Barstow or Baker, for those of you familiar, that's a couple of hours into the drive back to Vegas. I had to stop at almost every kind of exit, like a gas station, and drink, you know, Monster energy drink or whatever. And just a little tip here. If you have to do anything in this life that requires you to drink more than one Monster or Rockstar energy drink, you're definitely pushing yourself too hard. To get back into the show, for the UWF television title, Savannah Jack is scheduled to defend against Michael P.S. Hayes, Yuck Yuck. And Savannah Jack, he comes down to absolutely no reaction whatsoever. It's startling how quiet they are for him. I mean, Sting got a bigger reaction than him, and he's nowhere near that TV title level. I mean, you didn't hear his name in the top 10 earlier, did you? And Hayes, he attacks, there's no bell, and the other Freebirds run in because they are just on an absolute rampage. And from a storytelling perspective, it's a pretty good thing when you have a group running roughshod, you know, all the way up to the Nexus. It kind of captures the imagination, the Shield years after that, where you have a group of anywhere from 3 to 5 guys. It can't get to be too many. I mean, I know the Nexus was 7 in the beginning, but it was 7 rookies. So think of that as like the equivalent to 4 veteran guys, I guess. But the Freebirds, they all take turns dropping elbows like it's musical chairs or some shit on Savannah Jack. They each drop 3 elbows before Iceman Parsons is in to assist Missing Link. Chavo Guerrero is also there. And it was JR who actually compiled did the accounting on the 9 elbows. The picture on the video actually cuts to snow for a second, and I wondered what the hell was going on, or if it was going to cut to a promotional announcement from the New World Order. But we just get Hayes leaving with the TV title belt, so he's just going to take possession of it, probably because he's still pissed off about losing that legal battle before, but this time I think what he's kind of thinking by taking the belt with him is that possession is 9/10 of the law. I'm not sure if that really will fly in a Bill Watts style promotion, but some cool stuff from the Freebirds here. I mean, that's something, like I said, it's pretty timeless as you go through it, no matter what promotion you happen to be in. And as they go to commercial, we get the I Want to Be a Wrestler ad again, which they are... The mailing address is actually in Parsippany, New Jersey. And when I hear that name, all I can ever think of is in the movie Karate Kid, Daniel LaRusso's Uncle Louie was from Parsippany, but also that old lady with the dog who Daniel meets when he moves into that crappy apartment with his mom. Now, that woman, you may not remember, is Frances Bay, who most people of my age would probably know better as the grandma from the movie Happy Gilmore. The Karate Kid, when he comes into the apartment, she's got the little dog there. She's like, I got a nose for my own. When he's like, how did you know I was from Jersey? And then they go into the whole Parsippany thing. And then, Louis Fortini? No, Louis LaRusso. Louis LaRusso? Yeah? Don't know him. This is weird back and forth. And I wish I could find the clip for it. And I just literally spent 10 minutes. And I have the movie Karate Kid in my iTunes because a digital copy came free with the DVD. But unfortunately, I wasn't able to load it into... I wasn't able to actually load it into Audacity for whatever reason. I don't get it. So we go right to our final match, which is... Missy Hyatt is out for the Lumberjack match against Dark Journey, but she has her hand up on a pillow because she has what they are saying is a broken thumb. Now, I have no idea what the extent of her injury was, whether she actually had a broken thumb, but what I do know, because Missy Hyatt has said it several times, is that she did not particularly care for working with Dark Journey, and this isn't one of those deals where Missy hates all other women or anything like that. In fact, she liked working with Sunshine, and she kind of goes into it in the book that she wrote, Missy Hyatt, First Lady of Wrestling, which she co-wrote with Charles Salzberg and Mark Goldblatt. I forget exactly what year it was written, but here is what she had to say about Dark Journey. Working with Dark Journey was a nightmare from the very start. I mean, I guess I was a little spoiled from my experience with Sunshine, who always worked light and easy. But Dark Journey was the worst. She beat my ass every night. Didn't matter how much we rehearsed our moves ahead of time. She would chase me around the ring, just like we rehearsed it. She would grab me by my hair, just like we rehearsed it. And then she'd get a pop from the crowd, and she'd just snap. The adrenaline would get to her. She'd hear the crowd roar, and then suddenly it was like she went into vapor lock. And she says that, you know, that happens to lots of wrestlers. It happens to a lot of performance artists where, you know, sometimes you just get a little bit overhyped and you get carried away. And it just seems like Dark Journey kind of went overboard with Missy, and she did not particularly care for it. Now, I made fun of Missy Hyatt plenty when she was doing commentary back in episode 18, but a lot of that was from the perspective of Jim Ross seemed totally checked out from working with Missy Hyatt. I'm going to give Missy the benefit of the doubt because, you know, I had a childhood crush on her. I'm not afraid to admit that. And also my general love of boobs. So what I do also love here is that Sting is like the stooge holding the pillow. And I'm thinking, wow, this guy's going to main event Starrcade like years from now against Hulk Hogan and draw a crap load of money. But here he is holding a pillow for Missy Hyatt as Eddie Gilbert once again interrupts an introduction.
Wait a minute. First of all, I want to ask everybody here, everybody watching, to please don't hurt my baby's feelings because she's been in bad shape. Because, wait just a minute and let me tell you the story here. Earlier this week, my precious baby here, bless your heart, she broke her thumb this week, and it's real swell, real big. It's real swell. I'm sorry, honey. I'm sorry. And Carl Fergie, Missy Poo here broke her thumb this week, and she's not going to be able to wrestle that Mean Dark Journey, are you, honey? You're not going to be able to wrestle her. Because she's mean and she'll hurt her thumb worse, and she can't wrestle.
She hurt her thumb. Although traditionally the way to get Missy Hyatt out of a wrestling match, as we'd learn years later, is to have Dick Murdoch and or Dick Slater come down and just sort of abduct her and carry her to the back, as it happened at the Great American Bash 1991 in what was technically the main event, as it was the last match on the show to be her and Rick Steiner, who she's there with here at this point, to take on Paulie Dangerously in Arn Anderson. So, kind of funny how that's connected in that way. So, Dark Journey gets into the ring, and Eddie has a few more things to say.
I wouldn't lie to you, Dark Journey.
Ooh. His nose is growing longer.
Is that Missy broke her thumb this week, and she's not going to be able to rest because it swelled real big, and it hurts, don't it? It hurts her, and she can't wrestle you. She can't wrestle, Michael. She's hurt.
Dark Journey's here ready for battle, but Missy is quite obviously not dressed to wrestle.
Can't wrestle you, Dark Journey. I'm going to have to award you the match.
There you have it, the winner of the match, Dark Journey.
Well, Dark Journey's awarded the match by forfeit.
This has been a very interesting show because you have a tag team title match that never happens because the champions get jumped on the way to the ring. Then you have a television title match that doesn't happen because he is jumped before the bell actually rings. And then you have the women's lumberjack match that you've been promoting since the beginning of the show, and that's not going to happen because Missy Hyatt has a broken thumb. It's kind of odd that you would have three things on a single show that don't happen for various reasons, two of them being fairly similar. But okay, this show actually isn't that bad. I mean, it's an easy enough watch, and I don't find myself frustrated because of the angles that are coming along out of this. So once the match is awarded by forfeit, Eddie takes the liberty of grabbing Dark Journey, not jostling her around or anything like that, but Rick Steiner and Sting both grab her as well. So that brings out Missing Link, who actually kind of got jumped, and he is back in to make the save, along with Iceman Parsons, who kind of keeps turning up here. And eventually, everything sort of breaks down with the men fighting each other, and Dark Journey gets loose. And Missy has a handbag, a Gucci handbag, with her. So Dark Journey just kind of rips it away from her because she's got a hand injury, so she can't really hold on to it so well. And Dark Journey is like, let him have it, big boy.
Iceman King Parsons is racing by. The Missing Link is back in the ring. Iceman with that left hand on Eddie Gilbert. And now Dark... Guard Journey's got Missy's bag. And boom! She nailed Missy Hyatt with Missy's own Gucci bag. And Missy has been flattened. Guard Journey has knocked Missy Hyatt cold with Missy's own Gucci bag.
Well, at least Missy didn't get flattened in one way. That's a callback to my joke about boobs from earlier. So, fun little thing going on here. You know, Dark Journey gets one over on her for kind of bailing on the match. The guys fight, kind of continue that along. But this show, looking back on it, like I said, all these matches that don't end up happening, but yet it somehow is keeping my attention. Like, if this had happened on a WCW show in 1999 or 2000, I guarantee that I'd be walking away from it really pissed off. So they go to an ad break, and the commercial is for the Pro Wrestling Illustrated Hotline, which at $1.49 a minute seems pretty steep for the time period. You see a magazine cover on the screen. It says, Sting's Painful Lesson. And I'm thinking, okay, 1992. It's probably, the lesson is, not drawing as champion really pisses off the smarks and people who read the Wrestling Observer newsletter. So, after this, we kind of get a word from IWCCW at International World Class Championship Wrestling, and Kevin Von Erich randomly appears.
Fans, don't go away. We'll be right back, right here, with more of International World Class Championship Wrestling.
To find out how to have me or some of the other great wrestlers you see right here on this show from International World Class Championship Wrestling come to your hometown, watch this.
If you're looking for the best professional wrestling available anywhere in the world, look no further. International World Class Championship Wrestling is the best live professional wrestling available today.
It was? That was the best that was being offered in 1992? Now, taking that at face value, I would say, no wonder why business was down so much. Either that, or they're just out and out lying to me. Although, I think I spied a very young Tommy Dreamer as one of the wrestlers being shown there. And I learned this week, from listening to my pal Steve Bennett on the Sportscasters interviewing Jeff Pearlman, that he and Tommy Dreamer apparently are pals because their kids go to the same school. So why don't I just go into my plugs for other podcasts on the Sportscasters? Yes, indeed, Jeff Pearlman joins Steve Bennett for a pretty lengthy discussion covering a wide variety of topics, including Pearlman's desire to write a book on Tupac and kind of his interest in hip-hop culture and all that, being, you know, a white Jewish kid, and how, you know, how unusual that kind of seems to some people. On the Our Vantage Point podcast with Joe Morana and Michael Quinn, so their series, their royal rankings, has kind of been twisted for this set of 10 episodes that they're on now, where they're looking at the best and worst WrestleManias ever. And this week they look at WrestleManias 10 and 6. And I'm starting to believe that there is a generational divide between who would prefer WrestleMania 3 and WrestleMania 6. I think it's something along the lines of, if you're born after December 31st, 1981, you're going to prefer WrestleMania 6. And if you were born before that date, you would prefer WrestleMania 3. I don't know. It's not entirely scientific. I'm still working on the date. It's floating out there. And also, you know, kind of WrestleMania related, on the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with the Brawler, Brian Malonis of Ring of Honor, and Mike Crockett, they look at WrestleMania moments, and they had the audacity to name Seth Rollins winning the world title at WrestleMania 31 as a great WrestleMania moment, as if interrupting a 4.5-star classic between two guys in just a great Haas battle, and oh, he runs down and wins the title and isn't even in the match and kicks off like literally the worst freaking title reign. A title reign that made Diesel in 95 look like Hogan in 85, by way of comparison, I might add. Just completely terrible. Is there anybody out there who's like, you know what, instead of having a cage match between Ric Flair and Harley Race at Starrcade 83, wouldn't it have been cooler if Harley Race had fought Dusty Rhodes and then Ric Flair ran in 20 minutes into the match and pinned one of them to win the title? Oh, it would have to be he pins Dusty because, you know, you don't want to pin the champion to actually win the title. I mean, you know, that would be freaking stupid, right? Especially when you put him over the freaking Undertaker the year before that, you take away the streak, and, oh, okay, who's going to beat the guy who got the streak? Oh, well, clearly we can't actually have somebody beat him for the title. We have to give it back to the Undertaker with some bullshit SummerSlam 2015 finish. By the way, in case you're wondering, I really don't like 2015 WWF or WWE at all. Like not even one iota, okay? And clearly, I need something to calm myself down. And the last bit on this video actually provides it, because this is ICW, IWCCW. I don't even know what the hell it is. They're showing old UWF episodes for whatever reason. And to close it out, we get a random appearance from one of my favorites from WCW Prime. It's Chris Cruz.
All right, fans, that's going to do it for another exciting hour of International World-Class Championship Wrestling. I'm Christopher Cruz. Hope to see you next week right here.
Geez, you want to talk about your Krusty the Clown? I heartily endorse this event or product. I feel like that's what Chris Cruz was giving them. Apparently, though, and I learned this listening to one of the Between the Sheets shows, is that apparently Chris Cruz was brought in for one day to sort of record stuff like that, and they just kind of had made it all generic, which makes it sound even worse than it actually is. But that does it for UWF 1987, sort of, January 17th, 1987. J.D. Drew's grand slam in the first inning of Game 6 of the LCS in 07 redeemed himself in the eyes of a lot of Red Sox fans who never really took to him, never really liked him, even though he put up stats most of the time that he was in Boston. I mean, I thought he was an okay player for what it was worth, but it's funny because my mother, several years ago, she won some sort of door prize, and I don't know where the hell she was. She has a knack for winning these sorts of things. I think she's gotten her last two TVs that way. So anyway, this other time, she won an autographed 8x11 frame thing of J.D. Drew, and she gave it to me. And it's of him in a Red Sox uniform. And it's like, I'm hanging all this stuff on my wall, and I'm like, I can't hang this. Like, I don't know where. It's freaking J.D. Drew. So I'm just throwing it out there. If there are any Red Sox fans who want an 8x11 autographed thing, J.D. Drew, you're more than happy. You know what? I'll even bring it down with me WrestleMania weekend. You know what? Screw that. I'm not going to carry it around with me. That would be the most ridiculous thing. But let me know if you're really interested in that, because I'd like it to at least have a good home. Next week's show will be World Class Championship Wrestling for the very first time. And you want to know how I got the idea to do World Class? There's two things. Number one, listen to the WorldCast podcast on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. They're doing 1983 World Class, people. There's almost no promotion in year that's any better than that. But also because somebody left a 5-star review for Greetings from Allentown on iTunes and asked the question, hey man, how come you haven't done any World Class Championship Wrestling? So if you leave something like that, if you leave a 5-star iTunes review for me, and you leave some sort of, you know, comment like, gee, I really wish you would do blah, blah, blah episode of blah, blah, blah promotion, you know what? I'm probably going to do it. So on that episode of World Class, Michael Hayes actually makes his debut. So we're going to get a little more of him coming up next week. But first, I got a final piece of business to take care of here, and that is the return of YouTube Comment Theater. Now, there are quite a few comments on this video, about 60-something. Obviously, I'm not going to get to all of them, but these are actual comments made by actual YouTube users. In fact, some of them even have little pictures there with their names, so they're not hiding behind either the shadow thing, an egg avatar like it is on Twitter, or a Baltimore Orioles logo. Gloryland01 says, people talk about Jim Ross back during the Attitude Era in WWE and how good he was with the announcing. I said it 1,000 times through his time with Mid-South, UWF, and WCW, there's nobody better, and he sure was better then than the Attitude Era. And I don't know, I think he rose to the occasion in the Attitude Era and kind of matched what that needed, but I also like him a hell of a lot during this period. I mean, he's a guy that was good enough at one point that he made 1991 WCW palatable. I'm talking like in the late summer. Now, granted, I was a 12-year-old kid, and what the hell do I know about announcing? But I really enjoyed his work then. Rick James, not the actual Rick James, I would think, because it says 2 years ago when Rick James died in, like, 2004. Sting's career was almost over before it started. Yeah, when you land on your head like that, you're a 285-pound guy or whatever he is, it's kind of a risk there. Dwayne Sisto, kind of going back to the first comment, says, Terry Gordy telling JR in 87 that he was the best wrestling announcer going today. He hit it right on the head. So I don't know if he was the best in 87. He had a lot of yelly tendencies back in the day, and that was kind of a criticism of him. Manu Ginobili's bald spot says, Sting is a heel. DiBiase is a super over face. UWF was definitely Bizarro World. And that's why I love going back to these territories where you kind of flip the script on what they were in the WWF. Not even just like Hulk Hogan as a heel in the AWA or anything like that. Ted DiBiase is a babyface because you know him so well as the Million Dollar Man later on that you say, oh, he could be this other guy too. Twice-Baked 420 says, people going nuts when Born in the USA starts to play, not realizing it's a song slamming the USA. It's a little bit more complicated than that. There's a little bit more social commentary going on. Joe Wilson says, Freebirds were kind of the original NWO. Sort of in some ways. It wasn't like they were threatening to take over the territory, but, you know, they were kind of helpful for business everywhere that they went. And they were a three-man gang that would go in and beat the hell out of everybody and just kind of, you know, become a real focal point. So in that way, they were. Twice-Baked 420 weighs in again. $1.49 a minute for the hotline, 87. Could probably get a hooker in 87 for a cheaper hourly rate. Now, wait a minute. You could go to Orchids of Asia or whatever the hell that place is called. I don't know. It's probably more than $1.49 a minute. I don't really feel like doing the math on that right now. Wayne Thompson says, Sting and Steiner are really green here. Looks like some miscommunication going on in the squash match. And yeah, with the Sting going for the pin, the referee kind of stopping the count, I don't know what the hell was going on there. Maestro Dog 65 says, people forget about Bam Bam Gordy's ability to rap, to cut a promo. He wasn't as good as Michael Hayes, but he could hold his own. Yeah, Terry Gordy, if he had been allowed to talk a little bit more, he could have spread his wings and been like Walter from The Big Lebowski. Kevin Payton says, the UWF had a who's who of superstar wrestlers. It's a shame it had to fold. Had it not folded, the UWF would have given WWE and NWA major competition. And that I definitely agree with. It's certainly one of the great what-ifs. If only they could have spent, say, $1.1 million about that time slot, who knows how being on TBS would have changed Mid-South and later the UWF. And that'll do it for YouTube comment there. Again, thank you so much for listening. Next week, World Class, October 16th, 1982. Boy, I can't wait to talk about it because I've heard so much on it and watched so much of it following along the World Class podcast, especially Jay Saldi, who I think may be entering the Angelo Mosca Hall of Fame. And if you've listened to Greetings from Allentown enough, you'll know exactly what I mean by that. So do check it out. That, again, 5-star review on iTunes. If you drop a little thing like that guy did about World Class, you could definitely you might be able to get somewhere with it. I'll tell you, I want to promote those 5-star reviews, and also for the Pro Wrestling Only feed as well. But do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Nitty Poo here broke her thumb this week.